All right, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming. And so I have no relationships to disclose. There's no conflicts. Today we're going to be talking about a number of things. We're going to really kind of cover the lexicon of what you're going to be hearing about, buzzwords, acronyms, what they all mean in the real world, in the real world of payment systems and service delivery organizations. We're going to talk about the triple aim, but you probably know what that is. We'll go over it real quickly. But more importantly, introduce you to the triple win. We're going to touch on corporate wellness. We're going to touch on the coexistence of the triple aim and the triple win, because sometimes so many of us, myself included, really wonder how they can coexist. They seem to be sometimes at odds. The triple aim, for those of you that may not be familiar, was the aim set forth by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Improve the experience of care, improve the health of populations, and reduce per capita costs. So the triple aim requires certain preconditions to be met. First of all, enrollment is critical. We must achieve a high enrollment, as near universal as possible, in order for there to be enough money coming into the system. We also have to have organizations come together to commit to achieving that triple aim. And in doing so, they have to be creating partnerships. Can you all hear me? Because I'm stepping away from the mic.
We're not recording.
Oh, sorry. Thanks. I'll stay close. They partnerships with individuals and families, redesign of primary care to be profitable, and to provide increased quality and to get the quality metrics where they need to be. Financial management systems, macro systems integration like electronic health records and accounting systems and pharmacy links and quite extensive electronic software kinds of things. One such organization that would commit to that kind of bringing together all those elements is a patient-centered medical home. Now, there's nothing new about PCMH. The concept was developed in 1967 by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And it was designed to simply have a child's records, paper records, in one place so that, people could access if a child became sick. It's been used for many years. HMOs in the 70s were modeled after PCMH. And it's been used by certain disease, HIV and cancer, focused health providers for some time. It's got an overarching principle of care coordination across a health team, ideally located under one roof. The National Center for Quality Assurance summarizes it by saying it's what patients want healthcare to be. And it is focused primarily today, with some changes already happening, but it is focused, a PCMH has been focusing on the Medicaid population. Now, we're really going to look at ACOs because that's kind of like the real, that's kind of getting big and bigger than anybody sort of envisioned at this point. It's a network of medical providers that take responsibility. Primary care physicians are central to the model. It was originally designed for Medicare recipients. In fact, CMS set a ruling for an ACO to qualify that they had to have at least 5,000 Medicare recipients over a three-year period for an organization to be certified as an ACO. They can be run, an ACO can be run by any organization, really. It can be run by a hospital. It can be run by a physician group. It can be run by an insurance company. There's no hard rule about who's going to take the lead in running an ACO. 428 groups, according to Kaiser, is where we're at right now. And about 14%, again, according to Kaiser, is of the U.S. population is covered by an ACO. There's a catchphrase, I wouldn't call it viral yet, but, kind of a slow crawl, a very slow spread of something. If you've seen one ACO, well, that's all you've seen. You've seen one ACO. And that's because innovations are being really encouraged. And delivery and payment models have been virtually allowed. Anything that seems to work has been encouraged to be put into place, as much encouragement as possible. So it's led to all sorts of variants of the ACO. So we have PPO ACOs, HMO ACOs, we've got PCMH ACOs, blends. Minnesota, Cheryl Lee will be our representative from Minnesota, started banding together its FQHCs, Federally Qualified Health Centers. And they created a network called FUN, F-U-H-N, which was, you know, the first network of FQHCs to go the ACO route. So it's getting really blurry. It's getting really kind of, let's try this, let's try that, you know, all with good reason, all with good intention. But it's getting complicated. So how do ACOs get paid? Well, there are financial incentives to being an ACO. Those that save money while meeting quality metrics can keep a portion of the savings. Those that don't will simply lose money. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation did a study, and it was actually done by the National Regional Healthcare Improvement Organization, which showed that a hospital, if it adds 2% patient load, its margins, this is on average, its margins will increase by 50%, margins of profitability. But if it loses 2% of its patient beds, its margins will decrease, profit margins will decrease by 50%. ACOs right now, there's all sorts of ways of sharing money. There's ways to have no losses at all. Because CMS is encouraging this. So they're actually giving sort of an indemnity for those trying out ACOs who want to dip their foot in the water. There's Medicare Shared Savings Plan. That's one of the mainstream ACO plans. And then there's very high-risk plans called Pioneer. In the first year, we had huge savings of $380 million. Well, that sounds huge, actually. But only 29 of the 114 ACOs in the first year generated enough money to keep some. So we saw a lot of ACOs, in fact, 54 ACOs generated savings, but didn't generate enough savings for them to benefit. It's expected, again, this is according to the Commonwealth Fund, that ACOs are expected to save Medicare $940 million in their first 4 years. Keep in mind, $940 million, which sounds like an enormous number to us, is only 1% of Medicare spending over that same four-year period. So maybe some expansion. Again, I think it's the intent that this become larger and more encompassing. The Pioneer model that I mentioned with high risk, high payoff, went from 32 groups to 19 groups because they simply couldn't take the losses that people were experiencing. Now, losses, for example, the Franciscan Alliance in Indianapolis, in central Indiana, they were an ACO, and their overall quality score went from a 75 to an 84. Now, that's a lot of work in 18 months. It was an 18-month period. That is a lot of work. Now, granted, 84 is not a sufficient score, I would hope, you know, to settle on. But because it wasn't higher, they lost money. So all that work, and there's no doubt it took a lot of work in 18 months to raise that score that much, they were penalized for. They lost money. So they dropped out of the program. They are one of quite a few that dropped out of the Pioneer program. Again, quality metrics overall are rising, but not enough for the hospitals to find profitability. So here's the thing. So a lot of you in this room, I'm sure, are interested in health education. I'm a health educator. I'm an advocate for health education. Why does all this matter to you? And so to understand an organization's financial system, the challenges, it allows us to find out where we can insert ourselves best. It also allows us to do the advocacy necessary so that health educators remain as strong and as pertinent as we know we can be and as much a part of the care team as we believe is necessary, as we know is necessary. So we want to be able to advocate for quality metrics. We want to advocate for differentiating community health workers, but working together with them, because we play a part together in a team that will provide quality care. I'm looking for again, when we talk about metrics, what are you measuring? So, you know, 1 year savings may not be a good way to evaluate health education. In fact, it probably isn't if we're looking at population change. So we've got to promote our own profession, and that's you know, if you're a CHES or MCHES, you know, it's area 7 of our competencies, and for a health educator is advocacy, and even that's been increased, I believe, by NCHEC. Also, return on investment. If you're a researcher, if you're someone who's interested, we need more return on investment research. The fact is that there isn't a lot of return on investment research and data on health educators in general, not disease specific. There are, so if you're an asthma educator, there is data. But if you're a generalist, we don't have a lot of research, and that's something else that would be really, really useful and great to start embarking upon. These are simply the terms of healthcare reimbursement. They're not comprehensive, but it gives you a good showing of what is the lexicon that's out there. These are all models of finance, and as you can see, it's quite, you know, they're different. Some of them overlap enormously, but add in different layers. Now, I mentioned the triple win, and this is the hard, cold truth. We're still a system of healthcare that's driven by money. Okay, people have to be profitable. Even nonprofits have to be in the black. So don't let the nonprofit name get in the way. Hospitals have to make money. Physician groups have to make money. And payers, the public ones, CMS, the private ones, Blue Cross, Aetna, whoever it is in your area, they have to make money. Sorry. So these two slides, I'm just going to go through quickly. These are great graphics on accountable care and bundling systems. All these payment structures basically seek to bundle in some fashion services into one payment. This is what prospective payments are like. This is what global fee payments are like. There's all sorts of variants, and again, that goes back to the innovation. This full bundling model, I don't think exists yet, but it's a goal where you actually have full episode with warranty, which means, you know, a patient is guaranteed for 1 year under one payment. And that's a very fascinating model. Again, I don't know if it's actual existence, but it is talked about quite a bit. So the triple win, profitability, all those ugly things with finances and you know, profitability and healthcare kind of must coexist. We have to have providers stay financially viable. We have to work together with payers to identify savings and look at the barriers posed by certain models of finance. And very importantly for all of us in this room, advocates must be at the table to assure the right skill sets are being used for the desired outcomes. Okay. So, for example, if you're doing a disease intervention, do you need an RN case manager, or could a disease educator work in its place, or could a health educator, you know, generalist work in its place? All the different money levels that affect the overall profitability. And data. You know, sharing data across payers allows us to look at real costs, because right now that's murky area too. What is the real cost of an MRI? I want to just switch real quickly to corporate wellness. The Affordable Care Act has really incentivized corporate wellness. Strong incentives to the employee and employer. Large businesses have already widely adopted this. More and more are jumping on board. A recent study published in the American Journal of Cardiology showed a cardiac intervention for a workplace and showed in 57% of those considered high-risk cardiac persons, 57% of those at high risk were reduced to low risk within 12 months through the use of an education program at workplace site through corporate wellness. And this was by a health educator. So there's strong evidence. There is good evidence for corporate wellness. And by the way, P.S., the job market is hot. I can tell you that, at least on the West Coast, where I'm from, it's hot. The players, advocacy, where to, as I begin to finish up. All major insurance companies, CMS, the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform, major medical centers, state Medicaid offices, and the Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement, among others. These people are helping to create the metrics that measure quality. And if we aren't there educating these people about what we do and our competencies that you'll be hearing so much about with my co-panelists, we're missing our own opportunities. The Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement is a big one. It's a big player. And these slides, again, you can get these. They're uploaded onto APHA site, so you can download them. These are just the members of that improvement network for your region. So it really is comprehensive. And, you know, call them up. Literally call them up. Or call Sophie. And, you know, we're very involved in trying to advocate and become involved. So thank you very much. Boy, that was good.